It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Monday, January the 16th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And come join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Join us in the chat. Premium content for less than a cup of coffee a month. Updates on the show. And of course, you can even react to what's going on in the world of the Mets by interacting with me. All at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks on the Believe Network for supporting this show. Happy Monday, kicking off the week. Yes, we were normally going to come on Sunday, but with the way that the news cycle has been going, a couple of shows over the last 72 hours or such, I figured let me see what's going on. Early Monday morning here for many of you, a holiday, a three-day weekend. Hope you enjoy the extra day off, recover from the weekend. And who knows, maybe there'll be some baseball news. But pretty interesting show coming to you. We are going to talk about the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame announcement will be tomorrow. Big Mets connection with Carlos Beltran likely finally getting the call to the Hall of Fame. Long overdue, long road for Carlos. And, you know, some other Mets connections. And also David Wright trending upward, it looks like, in the Hall of Fame vote. So we'll talk about that later. Mets Hall of Fame. Get to your mailbag. But let's kick it off with the hot stove news. So it's been a wild, wild weekend. I mean, the weekend for us here at the Talking Mets podcast started Thursday night when the news came down that Kyle Tucker spurned the Mets to go join the super team in L.A. And I know I talked about it on the last show on Saturday morning, but I mean, what a turn of events. What a turn of emotions. Everybody went to bed pretty frustrated, tons of anger Thursday night. It bled into the morning. I did a show. We talked about the Dodgers. We talked about staying the course with the plan and the farm system. And the Mets can't just go out there and pivot because they lost out on a free agent and to satisfy the fan base. And then just hours after we had that conversation, the big surprise, and I think it's one of the biggest surprise signings of the offseason, Bo Bichette spurns the Phillies, signs with the Mets. Mets have now a third baseman. Bo Bichette will be transitioning from shortstop to third base. And the reports were that the Mets all along were looking to do sort of a Tucker-Bichette combo, if that's the truth, if those rumors are true. And maybe the Mets now are not done because Cody Bellinger's still out there. There's talks of them bringing in, and they're going to have to bring in another outfielder. I think they only have three or four outfielders on the 40-man roster. The pitching market is starting to heat up. Tarek Skubal's having issues coming to a contract accord with the Tigers. Nasty arbitration. There's rumors that the Brewers are now aggressively shopping Freddie Peralta. There's some upside arms on the market. So even though it's mid to late January, and like I said a couple of weeks ago, the 2026 season's in front of us, I know everybody's still feeling a little angry about the fact that, look, the Dodgers lineup is stacked. Their rotation is stacked. They got one of the best closers, if not the best closer in baseball, that they stole for the Mets. It's going to be hard to beat this baseball version of the 96 Bulls, this baseball version of whatever dynasty team, you know, the Dolphins, whatever you want to call it, that's now been put together. But that's not going to stop. And I think that's really the conversation about Hot Stove today. Is that going to stop the Mets? It doesn't look like it. And the interesting thing now is that all offseason, every conversation we've had has centered on a sane, tempered, yes, they will spend, but they won't go crazy and blow past last year's payroll, which they're right about where they are now. They're about 340-something at some point. I'll check it before the show's over. That's been everything that I've been talking about, that the Mets are not going to go wildly above the 340. Now, Steve Cohen said, hey, we'll do it, but only if it makes sense. So now, seeing that potentially they could be bringing it at a very low cost to Freddie Peralta for prospect capital. And the interesting thing about Bellinger wants a 7-year deal for $200 million. And it's not going to happen from the Yankees. And the fact that the Yankees did everything they can over the weekend to take every reporter that they possibly could tell that they were walking away, they were ready to move on, tells me that they're at their impasse, they're at their point, they're at their Pete Alonso point from last year, like the Mets were at Pete Alonso, where they're like, hey, we're ready to walk. Now, similar to Alonso, the fact that Bellinger hasn't figured something out makes you wonder, is he just trying to wait and give the Yankees every opportunity? Or at this point, has he pivoted and decided that, hey, I'm ready to go play somewhere else? So, actually, the Mets are at $338.2 million as of this morning. So, you would figure at this point, logic would dictate, Mets are going to go out, maybe get themselves a reasonable starting pitcher via trade. I'm not talking Peralta, Skubal. You know, maybe they'll be able to get a Lucas Giolito, something like that. Not somebody that would have compensation attached, like a Zach Gallen. I think Framber Valdez wouldn't fall under that because Framber Valdez is getting about $30 million a year. And then maybe they'll round the roster out with some non-roster invitees, vets, things like that. They have, I think, one roster spot. Actually, they're going to have to make a roster spot. They took up that roster spot with Bo Bichette. They did a minor league waiver claim over the weekend. So right now, that's what logic would say, that the offseason's pretty much done. They're going to get a pitcher, nothing sexy. They're going to run it back. They got their big bat in Bo Bichette. Their bullpen has been remade without Diaz. Time to get over Alonso. And that's what logic would say. But there's this part of me that thinks that after the Bichette move, after the news leaked about their desire to bring Tucker and Bichette together, that there's a strong possibility that the Mets at this point are looking to say, hey, you know, why should we sit back with Soto smack in his prime, Lindor in his late prime? We're in New York. The owner has put his chips from day one to the center of the table. Yes, the Dodgers are good. Yes, the Dodgers are historically good. They're not going to last forever. They got some players in their mid to late 30s, but early to mid 30s. And, you know, why should in a sport where the playoffs is a weighted tournament, why should we cede anything to the Dodgers? They're out in the West. You know, maybe we don't have to see them until the championship series. But, you know, you can't just retreat and hope for a better tomorrow because you don't know what tomorrow brings. So let's go out there and put our chips to the center of the table. We know how to develop. We know how to build a farm system. We have this farm system. They know who they want to keep to incorporate into the mix. Now, they're not quite where the Dodgers are now, where they've built up the equity and the foundation where players want to play here. They've seen a decade plus of success. They know it's not stopping. They have a great farm system. They have stars up and down the lineup that have signed there. They have a couple of championships. The Mets don't have any of that. The Mets have a really good, for the first time, farm system. They have a couple of really good stars. They play in one of the more desirable cities in the world. You want to argue that it's less desirable than Los Angeles, the West Coast versus East Coast. That's a whole separate debate. They are a historic franchise. Maybe they don't have the history of the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Cardinals, but they've now been around since 1962, and they have their own synergy when it comes to history. And yes, I've been hard on the fan base, and I will continue to be hard on the fan base, but if you win here and you make the postseason here, we have seen it. Citi Field's a great place to be. Everybody on the other side of the field saw how that team played in 2024 and the love affair. And when the Mets fans fall in love with a team, they fall in love with a team. And we've seen it with Pete Alonso. They fall in love with players. The problem is they beat them up from time to time and they're hard on them from time to time. And when they are building to that point of success, they tend to beat the team along the way, which makes life a lot harder. Separate conversation. So are the Mets about to put chips to the center of the table here and do something crazy? Like, really stick it to the Yankees two off seasons in a row and take their desired free agent away. Bring in Cody Bellinger. No, they're not going to give him a seven-year deal. Yes, I said at the beginning of the offseason I preferred him because of his versatility and his defense and his arm to Kyle Tucker. And I said, hey, give him a five-year, you know, $32 million deal, something similar to what Alonso got. That's not going to get it done because that's basically what the Yankees have done. I always felt there was a part of me that thought he was going to ask for $200 million over 7 years, which is, you know, a little over 30. He wants more, and I think on a shorter-term deal, he's looking for 37 to 40. You know, maybe the Mets just go in there and say, look, we're at this point. We know who we have in the farm system. We're confident we could sign players. Peralta's there. I mean, I think Peralta's a tad bit overrated. Like I said, I go back to, saw him in the postseason. Mets hit him pretty well. Good pitcher, top of the rotation arm. Haven't really tested him outside of a small market. I've always think back to Javier Vasquez. I had that conversation earlier in the offseason. Vasquez is a great pitcher in Montreal. Came to the Yankees and spit the bit. Always a good pitcher outside of New York, outside of the Yankees. You don't know anything about Peralta in that sense. But look, in this day and age, they're not going to factor that in. Organizations are not going to factor that in. We had that conversation with Devin Williams. Mets are going to go all in. So maybe the Mets say, look, we have these prospects. We have more on the way. We only have so much space to protect them on the 40-man. That's one factor that a lot of us forget. If you go on to Roster Resource, you'll see by December of this year, there's going to be a number of young players, especially with the kind of farm system the Mets have, that are going to have to be protected. And at some point, you're going to have to trade them or lose them, because not everybody's going to make the big league roster. So you know who you got to protect. Now, to get a Freddy Peralta, you need to have an elite pitcher in there. They can do that. They have to figure out of the Winnegars and Sprouts and Tongs, and I take McClain and I keep him out because I can't see a scenario where the Mets are going to trade him, even for a Scooble, unless Scooble was young and controllable. That would be the only way, and he's not. He's not controllable. He's getting very expensive. Will Watson, all these arms, can you package one of those that you feel is the one that, look, there could be pain on any of them, but you're less likely to feel the pain on maybe what another high upside prospect. Maybe they want something from the big league roster. I'd be careful about trading Brett Beatty at this point because you don't know the long-term commitment here of Bo Bichette. And Beatty, I do think, showed signs of starting to break out. And if you could have him and he has the ability to do what Jeff McNeil did, you just swapped one type of Jeff McNeil for another. And actually, Jeff McNeil version now of Beatty that has some power and could play first base and potentially has the upside to be an impactful starting player with a component that McNeil never had, which is the power piece. I would be careful about trading him, and I know that Will Salmon, who has really become the new version of what I used to say Martino was, very clued in, has said the Mets are not going to trade. Even Gelb said this. The Mets are not going to trade Beatty unless it's for a very impactful situation. Now, Peralta would fall into that category, but he's also a free agent. So can you see a crazy scenario where the Mets go out, they rip apart some prospect capital to bring Peralta in, to anchor this rotation? He's the guy that you'd hand the ball to in Game 7, a guy that's going into a season that he has to prove himself. He has to prove himself that he deserves the big contract. He may not be Scooble, but maybe he's going to go out there and say, hey, I could do a little bit of what Tarik Scooble has done as well. And then you bring Bellinger. Not only do you rip the heart out of the Yankees, and I know I played around on X and, you know, had some fun with the Yankees fans, you don't sign Bellinger because you want to hurt the Yankees. That's an added bonus to the whole situation. You sign Bellinger because he's a good player. Everybody's caught up on this Yankee Stadium nonsense. I don't think that that's as big of a factor. The guy, I know it was 6 years ago, 7 years ago, he won an MVP in LA, not exactly a bandbox. He's been through the gauntlet, has to remake his swing, has seen a lot of peaks and valleys like any ball player, but he more so than others. And he is a versatile player. He's a good component player. He's a very good component player. I know he's left-handed, but now that you have Bichette in the lineup with the switch hitters, it's a little bit more palatable to bring in another lefty. And he's a son of a baseball guy. He's been around the game. You hear nothing but good things. He's been with great organizations. Been with the Yankees for a couple of years. He's been with the Cubs. He grew up in the Dodgers system. I shouldn't say a couple of years, but the 1 year Yankees. So you have a lot here to like about Bellinger, and what a cherry on the top of an offseason where there's been a lot of inactivity. We spent more time talking about the players that are gone than the players that are in front of us or here by doing those two moves. That's the wild, hey, and at this point, is that so crazy? Is that so out of the realm of possibility? I wouldn't put it as highly likely, but I think it's out there. And after what happened this weekend with the news about Tucker Bichette and how they pivoted to Bichette, first of all, it goes to show you, like I said on the last show, you know, the Mets are not sitting here playing 1D. They're not they're not playing this like the Will Puns where we have this much money and then tomorrow we have that much money and, you know, come to me if you need something and they move like molasses. No, they're putting a lot of things going and they're pivoting quick. And that's how this thing is going to go. And they're willing to spend money in short spurts. And with all the things that are surrounding the CBA and labor, what a fun way to go into what could be the last sane season for a while in terms of labor peace. To try to put their chips in the center of the table and say, look, maybe we're not the Dodgers, but we're going to sure as hell try to stop them from winning another championship and from steamrolling their way through the National League. And what a long way it would go bringing in Bellinger and Peralta. Now, you don't want to do it irresponsibly. Bellinger's just money, and you won't lose any draft capital. Peralta is where the prospect capital, you have to be careful. You are going to need, like I said, and I'm still going to stand by that. Yes, it's fun to see all this big free agent money swinging around, checkbook baseball, but you are going to want cost-controlled players. I never want to go back and debate and worry about what happened with Pete Carl Armstrong for Javi Baez. I explained many times why at the time they had to kind of do that. But ultimately, you want to stay away from those kind of deals because, sure, the Mets could use a cost-controlled Pete Carl Armstrong right now in center field, albeit I think he's a bit overrated on the offensive side. Very good glove. But at some point, you know, you also need to import players that could help you win. The Mets are in a much different situation in 2026 than they are in 2021. But the last thing you want to do is trade an arm for a few months of Freddy Peralta, get yourself maybe into a round of the postseason, and then that arm goes on to give 5 or 6 years of all-star caliber pitching when right now the cost of pitching, I mean, Framber Valdez is looking for $32 million a year, is through the roof. And maybe a lot harder to fit into your roster if there's some kind of complicated salary aprons and stuff like that. I'm telling you, they've been saying for a while, the league is looking at the NBA as a way to curb the wild spending. I'm telling you on that. So that's kind of the wild idea. Now, on the flip side, the possibility exists that more tempered end of the offseason. They're going to look to get an outfielder. Names like Luis Robert Jr. has come up. Austin Hayes, a lefty masher. And I think the one that's, and I go back because this is where if he is this player, the player that we saw, and he's probably only going to, I think you could probably get him on a 2-year deal for $30 million. If he's the player we saw last year, 800 OPS, 17 to 20 home runs, gold glove defense at not one, but three outfield positions, including a premium position of center field, then Harrison Bader's the guy that I bring in. And when you look at and everybody talks about Taylor and rags on Taylor, and Taylor had a terrible year offensively, but Taylor has an elite arm, he's elite range. Bader has got outfield baseball instincts, range, not as good of an arm as Taylor, but a plus arm. When you put a Bader and a Taylor, and the fact that they could move through all three outfield positions and you don't lose anything, and then you could kind of do your thing with Soto and Wright or whatever, that to me is a very enticing option as well. Now, he's not the offensive player of Bellinger, but if he's an 800 OPS player, and I know he put up a lot of numbers in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia tends to be a hitter's ballpark. I didn't really break it down by Citizens Bank and outside, but he was playing well in Minnesota too. You know, maybe he's figured something out at his age. Was he 32? And look, this is a risk too. You give him a 2-year deal. Look, I love Bader, but by the end of his tenure during the OMG year, Bader was coming off the bench as a pinch runner defensive replacement. He had a horrible bat the last 6 weeks of that year. Didn't do anything offensively in the postseason. Taylor actually was put in because he was an upgrade offensively from Bader. But that's an option, Bader. Do you go out and do something like that, a little bit more tempered on the outfield front? You know, I still think giving up a lot of prospects for Luis Robert Jr., Austin Hayes would be a great lefty masher. And obviously Carson Benj is all in here. And the thing about Bader and Hayes is that allows them to hedge a little bit if Benj is not quite ready. You keep hearing from many sources, reputable sources, that the Mets really believe in Benj. And if Benj is a guy that gave you 15 to 20 home runs early on, 75 RBIs, decent defense in the corners, and that's where I continue to tell people. Everyone pencils him in center field. I keep hearing from people, and even Joe DeMeo over at the Mets pod brought this up over on X over the weekend, and Joe's plugged in and reads more about prospects than anybody, way more than me. And I think even Ernie Dove and I have had this conversation a little bit. Another guy that is way more versed in the prospects of the world than me. If he profiles better in the corners, not that he can't play center field, then you have to start wrapping your head around that. What better guy to bring in than a Bader to help teach the guy the rope? So I think that's more likely. I know there's also talk about trading for what we've talked about, the next upside pitcher when they're ready to break out. Chris Bubich and Mackenzie Gore have come up. They fit right into those, right into what I've talked about. I don't know what the cost is going to be. Bubich is a lefty, had Tommy John surgery, not a hard thrower, more of a movement guy. And he finally, after 2022 Tommy John surgery and having a long rehab and pitching out of the bullpen in 24, he finally made 20 starts. You'd be getting him at 27 years old. Lefties tend to bloom a little bit late. He's right there in the heart of his prime, ready to break out. Could you get him at a reasonable cost? And then can the Mets work with him? That's an interesting one. Mackenzie Gore, a little bit more polished. Mackenzie Gore had a down year, especially in the second half. ERA a little over 4. His peripherals are still really, really good. And he was an all-star, but he struggled down the stretch. Lost 15 games for a bad Nationals team. But here's a guy that, getting out of a losing situation, a second division culture. I know they just revamped the front office. Can he come over to the Mets with the Mets pitching technology and philosophy with Justin Willard, you know, Eric Jaegers, all these guys that have had some success, and can the Mets at the age of 26, smack in the middle of his early prime, bring something out? I mean, it's, again, another lefty, a couple of lefties. It's not going to be cheap. I'm sure the Nationals are going to tax the Mets in some way, shape, or form. Remember, Mackenzie Gore was part of the Soto trade from San Diego. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of Mets tax. So, you know, is that the route you go? Because once you go that route with Bubich or Mackenzie Gore, I think that Peralta's out. So it will be interesting. I think more likely getting the next ace up or the next top of the rotation that you have to develop type pitcher is more realistic. And I don't think it would cost as much as Peralta. And I just don't like the fact that you're renting Peralta unless you could figure out an extension. And I know Stearns knows Peralta. So there's part of me that says go to the deep end of the pool and that's going to be exciting. And I think that there's not a zero possibility. There is a possibility of that happening. A greater possibility of that happening, or I feel that maybe there was always the possibility. I feel a greater possibility of that happening today than maybe just 24 to 48 to 72 hours ago after how you saw them behave during the Bichette-Tucker situation. They're willing to go big on short-term deals. And now you're starting to wonder, with the situation that the Dodgers have put the whole league in, are they rethinking how much clutching of their prospects that they need to do? They're going to have to make some untouchable, whether that's, you know, McClain, we know, whether that's Tong, A.J. Ewing, Clifford, there's all these names. We don't really know what they feel about it, but you do know that at the top of the system, they have potentially a 35 home run bat in Clifford. They have a number of pitchers that could be top of the rotation. They have a speed glove guy in Ewing. They have this Jet Williams who is kind of a bit of an enigma. Maybe that's the guy that winds up being the chip that goes for one of these kind of players. A guy that, short guy with power on base, versatile. You know, is he a Jose Altuve type? I know I'm throwing out a name that could be a lazy comp or a bad comp, but that's, you know, sometimes that's the comp you get. So, buckle up. I know that usually late January we talk about Hall of Fame. It gets sleepy. We start to itch and pine for the hot stove to end and for the, you know, especially with the horrible weather we've had here in New York over the weekend with the ice and the rain and the snow and all the things. Usually this time of the year is we're starting to get the itch, but we're actually going to probably see some hot and heavy free agency and activity. And it'll be interesting how deep into the end of this pool the Mets go. I have a feeling it's not likely, but I think it's still the possibility that there might be some wild nights and emergency shows ahead of us. And can the Mets go for the jugular? That's the ultimate question. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's take a look at the Hall of Fame ballot, talk a little bit about Carlos Beltran, and I'll give you my thoughts on the Hall of Fame ballot. That and more right after this. All right, we're back. It's that time of the year again, the Hall of Fame. Not only will I talk here about my ballot, if I had one, about the Hall of Fame and give you some thoughts, and I will be releasing a ballot in the morning, tomorrow morning, I believe the announcement's on the 20th. That would be Tuesday. Give you an idea of who I would vote for. The ballot announcement comes later in the day, so you could read about this over at Talking Mets, which I have a big announcement. I didn't get into it in the first half of the show, but Talking Mets Beyond the Mic has been rebranded. I've been thinking a lot about this to Talking Mets Extra Innings. And now, and I had put this in the chat room, if you're a subscriber, premium subscriber to Talking Mets Extra Innings, you could get an RSS feed just like this podcast. You could get an RSS feed to get the updates in your phone as part of that commercial-free podcast. And then obviously the premium content that's not going to be on for everybody else. There's still going to be plenty of free content. There's going to be a show every week. When there's big news, I'm going to be coming to everybody. But then there's those little vignettes, I call them, in between. We're probably going to do more of them during the season, reacting to some things that happened during the week, during the games and things like that. But big news, Talking Mets Beyond the Mic is Talking Mets Extra Innings. And for those who are premium subscribers, you'll be able to get this ballot, and you'll get to see some context of the ballot tomorrow morning, the morning of the big announcement. But for now, we'll put that aside, and let's get to where we're at here. So just to set the stage, there's some first-timers on the ballot this year, and I'm not going to get into each one of these, but you have Rick Porcello, you have Matt Kemp, Gio Gonzalez, Daniel Murphy, former Met, Hunter Pence, Nick Markakis, Howie Kendrick, Edwin Encarnacion, Sinshu Chu, Alex Gordon. Mets fans remember him of the Jiris Familia quick pitch fame in the World Series. Ryan Braun, Cole Hamels. And, right now I think out of the newbies, Cole Hamels is one. And I actually went over to see our friend Ryan Thibodeau, who collects all the ballots. He's not on X anymore. He's on Blue Sky. So I have a good feeling. But out of the first timers, I think Cole Hamels has probably the best case, because during his career, and Mets fans know him very well, he played for those Phillies teams, the golden age, I call it, of Philadelphia baseball from like 2007 to like 2012. He played for those very tough Phillies teams. He actually, early in his career, up until the point he was traded to Texas during the 2015 Phillies rebuild, he actually had a better wins above replacement, according to Baseball Reference, than Roy Halladay. So maybe he's a little bit underrated, Cole Hamels. And then if you look at Cole Hamels in terms of his postseason moxie, let's just bring this up really here. Postseason moxie. He actually had some big postseason moments. Not a bad postseason pitcher. I mean, I don't really take that too much into account. But in 2008, when they won the World Series, he was big in the NLCS, pitched well in the World Series, and I think that he was a big part of that championship team. So I think Cole Hamels, and as of this writing, as of this show, Cole Hamels is, with 50% of the ballot, Cole Hamels is at 31.1%. So he's not going to obviously be elected this year, but that's a very strong first-year showing. And I know there's other Philadelphia Phillies that we're going to get to, but, and we'll add, it used to be the Philadelphia Trio, now it's the quintuplets, the Philadelphia quintuplets on the ballot. All these, from the golden age of Philadelphia baseball Phillies that were the rivals of the Mets, now showing up on the Hall of Fame ballot. But, so we start there, that's your first comers, and I probably should have started, because I kind of got off track here, but I should have started with just reminding everybody, how do I assess the Hall of Fame? And it is, the total benchmarks are important, although with the commoditization of home runs and some of the things that have happened with starting pitching, those are going to become harder to just put out there as the marker. But 3,000 hits, 500 homers, 300 wins, you got to take those things seriously. I prefer a period of dominance. I would like almost a decade, close to a decade. I know that that's a little bit harder in this day and age. I'm having a hard time with writers, more or less being okay with 4 or 5 year periods or very short periods of dominance. I like there to be a longer period, at least 7 years, preferably 10. If there's precedent where a player like that player was put into the hall, I'd like to use that at times to say, hey, maybe then that gives them more of a case. I'm careful with that. This isn't the court of law. But we have to take precedent as seriously. Historic moments like Jack Morrison and his big performance in the World Series in Game 7. Those are the kind of things that you have to factor in. Look, I'm not going to say you want to have a serial killer in the Hall of Fame, but character is not what I first look at. It's about on the field. I'm not going to get I'm not going to start to be the judge and juror of people's behavior. That's not what this is all about. Ideally, I like a player that's more complete on both sides of the ball. But if you're dominant in one area, Dick Allen, who recently was elected by the Veterans Committee a year ago, very good hitter, one of the better hitters of his era, is a perfect example of that. And I combine traditional stats with advanced metrics and touch and feel. So what I've observed when you start to look at, as of this morning, with 50% of the ballots being given to our friend Ryan Thibodeau out there, who you catch over, you can't get him on X, you get him on Blue Sky. Beltran's at 89.2, and Andrew Jones is at 83.5. Both should easily make it into the Hall of Fame. I am all on Beltran. I am not in on Andrew Jones. But, you know, we'll get to that in a minute. So those should likely be the Hall of Fame inductees that will join Jeff Kent in Cooperstown this summer, which is interesting because all these players that were part of how I cut my teeth when I really became a young adult in the 90s, watching baseball, learning baseball, a lot of great baseball experiences, even though I'm very familiar with the late 80s Mets, I was a very young man. The 90s was where I really cut my teeth in sports in general, and now I'm starting to see these guys age out, go into Hall of Fame, and it's kind of a weird feeling. But just under the threshold, who won't be elected but are showing very strong showings, but you have Chase Utley at 67.9, Pettit, Andy Pettit at 57.5, King Felix at 56.6, and then you're starting to see a little percolation with the A-Rods and the Manny Ramirez's. It's Manny Ramirez's last year on the ballot. He won't make it. He'll fall off 40% of the vote, Manny Ramirez, Bobby Abreu 38, and then so on and so forth, so down the line. So what would I have as a Hall of Fame vote? Who would be my Hall of Fame? So on this ballot, and here's how I'd go. I'd go Beltran, A-Rod, Manny Ramirez, and Dustin Pedroia. That would be my Hall of Fame ballot. And I'll go real quick into that. Do I have to really get into David Wright? I mean, I love David Wright. I know there's that Mets component there. David Wright was Eddie Matthews, was on track to be one of the best third basemen of all time. Up until 2009, a combination of Citi Field, we've talked about this a lot, combination of Citi Field, bad back, injuries, wrong place, wrong time, derailed his career, too short of a period. And I'll tell you what, in a lot of ways, similar to Chase Utley. Utley had a really good 4 or 5 year run because he didn't play as much later in his career, even though he put up good numbers. That's why I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. And I think Jeff Kent, who has similar numbers, he stayed a little healthier and produced and played every day for a little bit longer. So that's why I say yes to Kent, no to Utley, and the same reason why I would say no to David Wright. So, you know, that's how I would just say that real quick, just to get into David Wright. But ultimately, A-Rod is an easy one. I know everybody, because I don't get crazy on the steroids, but I really think the thing about A-Rod is A-Rod stayed in Seattle and stayed as a shortstop and stayed away from trying to hit 700,000 home runs and was a 35 to 40 home run, 30 to 40 stolen base, good premium glove shortstop for a longer period. That would have been a much better player. It's almost like what I say about Barry Bonds. The Barry Bonds that was the gold glover, hit 35 home runs, stole 30 bases, was more a complete player, was the better version than the video game version, which is really the crazy thing. And I really think going to the Yankees, as much as it was meant to enhance his Hall of Fame candidacy, and maybe if he didn't get caught with the PEDs and the off-the-field drama, nobody would have known, and then he would be in the Hall of Fame. His intent of going to the Yankees to win a championship, to enhance his resume, actually hurt him. Because I really think the Seattle version would have been an exciting version to see more of. So that's the A-Rod component. I figured I'd just start with that because you have the A-Rod component to the whole situation. Manny Ramirez, I'll get into him, you know, because he's not going to make it. Mike, why would you vote for him? You know, PEDs and everything. I mean, I think it would be later in his career he did that. But make no mistake about it, Manny Ramirez is one of the greatest right-handed hitters of all time. Career OPS of 996, 335 against left-handed pitching. Top 25-ish, I think he's still in the top 25 RBIs all time. over 500 home runs. Look, Frank Thomas is in the Hall of Fame. Miguel Cabrera, guys like that. They are, he's every bit the hitter those guys are. All right? I mean, this is a guy that's in the same run creator mold as Hank Greenberg, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays. You know, as I, the kind of platitudes I give a Juan Soto for his offense, I mean, this is, that's Manny Ramirez, but from the right side. I don't think he'll make it in the Veterans Committee. I don't think Manny Ramirez will ever be forgiven. I think a combination of the PEDs, and he was a goofy guy. He forced his way out of Boston, would always do goofy stuff. The writers in the Vets Committee, they just don't like that stuff. I mean, maybe down the road, maybe there's some forgiveness. But and I'll go back to A-Rod for a minute. I think A-Rod's better showing has a lot to do with him being on the air. See, Manny Ramirez is not going to do anything, unless I'm mistaken, with the whole media component. So I vote for Manny. I voted for Manny every year he's been eligible. He's not going to make it. He'll fall off the ballot after this year, and that'll be the end. I think the controversial pick for me in the past, and I've talked about it, is Dustin Pedroia. So Dustin Pedroia may not be the offensive player that Jeff Kent or Chase Utley in his prime were. But Dustin Pedroia had a great glove. He was a team leader for those Red Sox teams. Won a couple of championships. A doubles machine. Had as much as 54 doubles in a year. And a really good player. Now, is he trending more towards the Mazeroskis of the world? He's a better hitter than Bill Mazeroski was. Bill Mazeroski was an elite glove. And he was never the hitter that a Jeff Kennan and an Utley were. But I take those leadership intangible components, and I right now, let me look at where he's at. Pedroia, and I just missed, I just had him here. Here he is. Pedroia is at publicly available ballots. 50% of the ballots is at 25.9. So he's not horrible, and he's a guy that I could see as the years go by and the ballots may thin out, might get more support. But he's slightly higher, 6% higher than David Wright, and I think he's got way more of a Hall of Fame candidacy than Wright, so we'll put it at that. So there you go. And then, you know, the Carlos Beltran, and I'll tie in Carlos Beltran with Andrew Jones and Torrey Hunter, because Torrey Hunter is like probably going to fall off the ballot. And Torrey Hunter is, what, a 5% public ballots. Torrey Hunter right now, how many years has he been on the ballot? This will be his sixth year on the ballot. And as of this writing, 5.7. So he's probably going to fall below the threshold and fall off. When you look at the three center fielders that are up for candidacy, Beltran, Hunter, and Jones, what I find interesting is that if you say Andrew Jones is a Hall of Famer and you say Torrey Hunter is not even close, I mean, they're essentially the same players. Andrew Jones played in Atlanta. He played in a lot of postseasons. You want to quibble that he was a better defensive player. He was probably in his era, not probably was, the best defensive center fielder out there. Little too la-di-da at times. He was that good. Big home run as a young man of the World Series in 96. Probably if the Braves had won that series, that might be talked about more for his performance early in that series at Yankee Stadium. But I just find it interesting, the perception of Andrew Jones and how Torrey Hunter, who I don't think is a Hall of Famer either, because when you start to look at their body of work during the commoditization of home runs during that era, Torrey Hunter, Andrew Jones, Jim Edwards, Mike Cameron, I'll throw Mike Cameron in there, you guys, Mets fans know him, all elite glove, power hitting center fielders. And all the same, very good, but not Willie Mays. I mean, yes, Andrew Jones was probably every bit the glove of Willie Mays. Maybe that's baseball sacrilegious, but very good. Now, Beltran, different level. Beltran is a guy that has 2,700 hits. Beltran is a guy that was the top of the sport at his position, was a big free agent. If you go to Beltran, when he had that postseason performance against the Astros, it was against St. Louis. I mean, imagine how his free agency would play out today. We talk about Juan Soto and Kyle Tucker and all this. Imagine how his free agency would have played out where the Mets won that sweepstakes, stealing away from Houston. 2,700, like I said, 2,700 hits, 300 plus stolen bases, three gold gloves, 453 homers. the mentions of his game on both sides of the ball that those other guys don't have. He's just one of six players who have achieved these offensive feats. 16 postseason home runs, an OPS over 1,000. He gets criticized for that Hall of Fame curveball from Wainwright, but he was a big-time postseason player. He will make it. He's jumped up quite a bit. I know he got dinged because of the sign stealing. He lost his job as managing the Mets because of it. And I think the thing now that Beltran's in the Mets front office is Beltran was that young kid, didn't speak English, that had to find his way in baseball. He was the up-and-coming hotshot rookie. He was at the top of the free agent class with all that pressure that comes from the big contract. He was that veteran that was injured that had to make a comeback. I thought he was done after he had the knee surgery. Came into spring training in 2011. I always tell this story. Talked to one of his teammates. He said he doesn't look good. There was talk about him not being able to play more than 3 or 4 days a week when Terry Collins first took over. Guy not only became everyday player, maybe not the same level of defense and speed that he had, but still an elite offensive player as he was before. And he wound up yielding the Mets on the way out a top-notch prospect in a trade in Zach Wheeler. I mean, what more could you ask? I mean, he should have been in the Hall of Fame from the jump. And I mean, I think it's funny how now the sign stealing, it's almost like the media said, you did your time in jail. It's okay. You know, move on. But, you know, that would be my bout. Now, this notable omissions here, I know what you're going to say. Look, I'm going to go back to Utley and Rollins and Abreu. I think Abreu was a money ball player, high on base, very good player. I know he won a gold glove, but I saw him play. I don't think he was a great offensive player. Jimmy Rollins had a couple of good years, but Jimmy Rollins was a very good player. I think his candidacy gets more amped up because of, you know, where the team to beat and his big 2007 season. Utley has the best case, but again, he was very good, elite, for 4 or 5 years. Then he got hurt. I just don't think his candidacy is long enough. I think that he might, as the ballots go forward, he might be one because he's at 67.9, that because of Kent will benefit going forward, and I could see a pathway for him. I could definitely see a pathway for him. Now, Andy Pettit was a really good Yankee, known for his big performance in Game 5 of the World Series, but he wasn't a great postseason pitcher. He was as much likely to get knocked around in a postseason game as be what he was that day in Game 5. And look, that will go down as an all-time performance. He beat John Smoltz. Yankee fans, it started the dynasty. They don't win that game, they probably don't win the World Series. It's a whole different dynamic going back to Yankee Stadium. 256 wins, something that you probably won't see very much anymore in the era of bullpen and short outings and specialization. But Andy Pettit is not a Hall of Famer. He's a very good pitcher. And if Andy Pettit wasn't with the Yankees, I think he might be more Mark Burley than he is Andy Pettit. So just keep that in mind. King Felix is one that maybe you guys will have an issue with me saying he's not a Hall of Famer. A really good pitcher who is Hall of Fame elite for 3 seasons. His claim to fame will be, hey, we don't judge pitchers on wins. He was like the first guy that, because he was so dominant and Seattle couldn't score, he didn't win any games, that was the debate back then. I still remember it. I was running NYBaseballDigest.com at that point. What's funny is that Sabathia, who I had some questions whether Sabathia should have been a Hall of Famer, he wound up getting in, and he has a strong case, but Hernandez's 2010 Cy Young season was better than any individual performance that Sabathia had, including his 2008. So he had a good season. He had some really the best seasons ever. But what's funny is, like, we all talk about Sabathia. He never had the season that a King Felix had. Maybe it was the timing, Seattle, whatever it may be. It just, to me, just doesn't have a long enough period. We can't just say that three-year period. And this is, I think, what you're starting to see with the different voters coming in from the BBWAA. As the new generation of voters come in and the old generation gets pushed out, is that I think they're going to be more inclined, which is somewhat of a good thing, and I wish some of the steroid guys would have benefited from this earlier in their candidacies, that they're going to lean less likely to worry about the steroid situation. They're going to, similar to what I think happens with Springfield and the NBA Hall of Fame, they're going to take shorter periods of excellence and reward that. And I think they want more people in the hall. And I think from a marketing standpoint, look, you're a Phillies fan. How great would it be to see Chase Utley get elected? More likely, you make a trip to Coopertown. So it's good for business. I look at this where I'm not a small haul. I'm not a big haul. I'm in the middle. I really am. I like to see a balance. And when I look at this ballot, the only true Hall of Famers I see that weren't just elite for a season, couple of seasons, but had some sustainability are Beltran, Manny Ramirez, A-Rod. And look, you want to debate Pedroia? I could see that as being debatable, but I factored in some of the intangibles that were out there. And I know Red Sox fans will probably agree. Yankees fans might not. And to me, that's where it goes. You know, as far as what I think will happen, I think Cole Hamels and Andy Pettit are going to have real good shots at some point at getting elected. You know, I didn't even bring up Ryan Braun. Ryan Braun is, you know, decent, very good hitter, just very good hitter when there was a lot of very good hitters. You know, I don't think there's really anybody else here that we should be talking about. I think the biggest debate would be Andrew Jones. I know that people have been itching to get him in. I think his Braves connection, the fact that he played for the Braves, helps him. But when you look at him as a player, when he came up, he was a very good hitter, 25-30 home run guy, elite gold glove defense. He started becoming a corner home run hitting, more bloated player post-30. If you want to talk about a guy that, and look, I don't know, I don't want to put any accusations, but they all worry about performance-enhancing drugs. He bloated himself much later in his career, became pretty much a home run guy, probably because he wanted to, and I know he hit 434 for his career, and if he hit another, you know, 70 home runs-ish, 500 home runs, I guess it doesn't matter. He's a shoo-in. But, I mean, 90-plus of those home runs came in 05, 06, late in his career, where he just exploded, and there was also an explosion in offense as well, when home runs became more commoditized. So, again, I think if you're going to say he's a Hall of Famer, then Jim Edmonds is a Hall of Famer, then Torrey Hunt is a Hall of Famer. They're all the same. They're all the same, in my opinion. One guy played for the Braves and had a little bit of mustard on the hot dog. The other guys did not. So that's kind of my thoughts on the Hall of Fame. I'll get deeper into it over at Extra Innings and dive a little deeper. This is kind of a quick summary to get your beak wet and that. So, all right, let's take a quick break. I'm going to wrap up. When we wrap up, I'm going to take mailbag. I'm going to talk about the Mets Hall of Fame, and we'll get back into that and more right after this. All right, we're back. Final thoughts, Mets Hall of Fame, mailbag. Have a few mailbags to get out on the way before we wrap up. So the Mets Hall of Fame. So Beltran will be inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame along with Lee Mazzilli and Bobby Valentine. And I wonder, because this conversation came up a couple of weeks ago, I think we addressed that on the mailbag, where those who said, hey, Jacob deGrom is potentially somebody who should have his number retired. And I said, Mets Hall of Fame for sure, number retired, I'm not so sure. Beltran likely will get into the Hall of Fame with a Mets hat. So this is actually a Mets celebration. And I feel like, and I hope it doesn't come down to this, I feel like because of the fact that Beltran was traded, he got hurt, the whole strikeout, Wainwright, 06. I feel 06 in that at-bat has clouded how good his season was that year, how good his postseason was. And I know that everybody says, well, when they needed him the most, he wasn't there. That was a Hall of Fame curveball. He got beat. And I've talked about this. I think the mistake he made is he took a pitch, a fastball early. I think that, and Wainwright has talked about it, if I don't remember, he was nervous. He wanted to get one over. I thought if he had jumped on the first pitch, Wainwright, that was probably his best pitch to hit. I think that's where the at-bat was lost. And it was a tough pitch. Now, some people have said, was it a strike? It's a pitch that the way it's framed, the way it looks, maybe with ABS, would it be something different? That was a strike, in my opinion. That's a whole separate situation. So I hope that that's not the case. This is a reason to celebrate. He was a transformative free agent signing. Before Juan Soto came, he probably was the best free agent signing that the Mets have had. And it was at a time when they were still smarting over the failures of 15 years earlier of Bobby Bonilla. I think Beltran is a guy that, as long as he's with the Mets organization, players like Soto, got players who signed big contracts that come here and have to go through a New York adjustment. We'll see if Bo Bichette goes through that, although he doesn't have the same long-term commitment. Should go to Beltran because he went through the gauntlet. He was a guy that had a horrible, not a very good first year. Had a massive injury colliding with Mike Cameron in the outfield. Could have been much worse. Could have ended either their careers. Came out the next year, started out slow, was booed, hit a home run at Shea Stadium. Didn't want to give the fans the curtain call. Julio Franco convinced him to go out, and the season took off after that. And his 2006 season is right there, 1-1A, with David Wright's 2007 as the best overall both sides of the ball seasons in Mets history. 41 home runs, 116 RBIs, and the only thing he didn't have, and it was the beginning of him and his knee, because he did that year miss about 20 games, mainly because of a sore knee. It was the beginning of his knee acting up, which robbed him of his speed, because he probably would have been a 40-40 guy if his knee hadn't started barking, and started to rob him of some of his defensive prowess, which was elite. He was an elite. We took him for granted, I think, how good he was in center field. I mean, not just the catch at Tall Hill that everybody sees in Houston, but I mean, plenty of catches that he made look routine. He was an elite player. He's one of the best offensive players in Mets history. Might be the overall best all-around player in Mets history. And other than Strawberry and Wright, has the third most win shares according to Baseball Reference in team history. Maybe if he stuck around a couple of more years, he would have been ahead of Strawberry. So, you know, he's clearly somebody that should be considered for number retirement. I really believe that. And he's with the organization, and he's having an impact now in the front office. He wanted to be a manager. I don't know if that's still something that's on the table down the road. Maybe he feels his impact in the front office in other ways is greater without the grind. I respect that. And, you know, I think that that's something that should be on the table. I think the Mets Hall of Fame is the first step. And I hope that when he does get inducted, we'll have a bigger conversation about him and a deeper conversation about him when that happens, that that's something that we bring up. And I'm sure it'll be talked about. Now, as far as Lee Mazzilli and Bobby Valentine, I'll get to Bobby Valentine last. Lee Mazzilli, heartthrob, the only shining star at a time in the late 70s, which is probably the darkest period in Mets history. I know some Mets fans who grew up in the 90s, the worst team money can buy, talk about that as being a dark period. That was not as hopeless. I think that that was a bottoming out, and then the team quickly, in a couple of years, became relevant again. Lee Mazzilli was, I mean, kind of a little bit of a surprise. I wasn't sure he was a Mets Hall of Famer because he had really three very good all-star type years, left to go to Texas, really was a part-time player most of his career, elite pinch hitter, came back a key bench player as part of those late 80s Mets teams, big at-bats in the World Series in 86, have no problem with him being in the Mets Hall of Fame. I think Mets fans who grew up from the team watching them in the 60s and the 70s probably have a more proclivity to think of Lee Mazzilli as one of the core Met greats of all time. I think he's a very good component player on a championship team, local guy. So nothing wrong with that. Not sure about that one a little bit, but no harm in that. I don't want them to turn the Mets Hall of Fame into the Mets Hall of Very Good as well. Maybe Lee is part of that, but I think his intangibles of how he was this heartthrob, local guy, the shining star during a dreadful time in team history in the late 70s, and then came back as a local guy to win a championship as a key bench piece. And maybe a really, like, that was their deadline deal, the Mets, that year. And it turned out to be a big one in 86 because he helped in that World Series get on base late in those games against the Red Sox and played a key role. So no problem with that. Probably the only one I have a question about. Now, Bobby Valentine, very controversial. We all know the mustache and the fights with the players and the Sports Illustrated articles. I have five losers in there in the middle of a pennant race. And he and Steve Phillips going at it. And him taking the fall for a disappointing, I mean, everybody talks about the worst team money can buy, but I would say the second round of that was how they, after 2000, they failed to sign Hampton. They failed to sign A-Rod. They had a down year, that a great late run after 9/11 in 2001. Then they went out, they got Robbie Alomar, they got Bo Vaughn, they tried to import some of these American League bats to spruce up the offense. 2002 was a disappointing year. They had a I don't want to say collapse, but I think they lost something like 12 or 13 games down the stretch in 02 at home. And Bobby V took the fall. And I think that was the start of what really has been a trend where the Mets have really been searching for a manager ever since Bobby came in. Now, Bobby came in, the Mets were coming off the worst team money can buy. Let's put it in perspective. Generation K had fizzled out. The Yankees were on their way to their first World Series. Dallas Green, who would have been a great manager post-Davey with that clubhouse, needed some discipline. Maybe even late in the Davey, maybe in like 89, 90, might have been a great manager for those late 80s teams when they were on the downslope of their arc, of their competitive arc. But probably the wrong guy, not probably, was the wrong guy for a young team. So Bobby came in, and he's done something that you really won't see. And I think that's why he and Steve Phillips, you won't see today, that's why he and Steve Phillips argued a lot. He really made it about him. I mean, the late 90s Mets was Piazza's Mets, Alfonso's Mets, Leiter, Hampton. Well, you know the characters, Olerud, Ventura. But at the front of that was Bobby, because Bobby was so much the media face. And a lot of ways, I think he took away a lot of the pressure by putting it on him. He was great at incorporating component players and making them the best version of themselves. Matt Franco, Benny Agbayani come to mind of that. Ray Ordonez had some of his best years under Bobby. It seemed like Todd Pratt. I mean, these guys were essentially, especially Franco and Agbayani and Pratt, scrap heap guys, and came here and played key roles. He always had a knack for finding ways of evaluating talent, looking at guys that other teams were not paying attention to, and finding a way to get them incorporated into the lineup. And I think he's probably the last transformative Mets manager who came in and made a difference. I mean, Buck did that. Think about how Buck came in and did that, an old school manager. You haven't had many managers like that over the last 20 years. I mean, you have your Parcells and your Rileys and Buck with the Yankees, and Bobby's one of them. And I think Bobby deserves it. And I think Bobby's somebody that should be honored and talked about more, and is an important piece in Mets history. I don't think you have the late 90s Mets at the same level without Bobby. And look, players had issues with Bobby. And I think that part of Bobby's issues was he liked to challenge and play mental Django with them. And when you're in 162 games in 180 days, you don't want to deal with that all the time. He certainly had his time. His missteps with the media, going to the college and speaking about clubhouse issues, not realizing that we were in the early days of social media where somebody posted it on a forum. I mean, you can't say, you know, what happens behind closed doors at a college and not expected to get out. He didn't realize that we weren't in that non-digital age. The Sports Illustrated article, like I said, in September of 99, where he called five of his players on the roster losers, battles with Ricky Henderson and Bobby Bonilla, Steve Phillips, Todd Hundley. I mean, he had his run-ins with players. And he was a bit of a my way or the highway guy. You don't see that anymore. But certainly someone long overdue for the Mets Hall of Fame. I think, next to Davey Johnson, the best manager in team history. He and Davey are right there. Different type of guys, but right a little bit cut from this bombastic same mold. I have not seen anybody at those guys' levels since. And I don't know, but the way that managers are now, I don't know if we'll ever see it again. So that's my thoughts on the Mets Hall of Fame. Let's get to the mailbag. All right, let's start out. Where do we got here? Mailbag. I'm not going to go too... George wrote to me, the way the Tucker tweet from Steve Cohen went down revealed serious ownership issues. Your owner should not be talking about ongoing contract negotiations. That tweet is right up the line of a CBA violation. You are not allowed to make public comments intended to deflate a player's market value. You can't make smart-ass remarks about the top player in the market when you aren't getting him. It also misleads the fans. When other teams laugh at you, about this, it's an actual problem, not a perceived one. You go through the weird general manager searches over the years, Correa deal, whatever the hell happened in 23 with Scherzer and Verlander, locker room being a nuclear mess the last 5 years. This is not the first time they've thought they got a player in free agency when they didn't. This has happened the other times in the past, Bauer, Mats, Tucker, and Diaz, just naming a few. It's been a messy ownership. Well, George, I see some of your points. I really don't think he misled the fans. I don't think everybody understood waiting for the smoke. He was like basically saying, hey, I'm waiting much like you. And then he clarified it. I guess that was something that fell, you know, maybe the fans took it as like, I'm waiting for the news I have to drop. I could see that. I thought it was fun. I think we can't take ourselves this seriously. I don't think it's a CBA violation. He's not under contract with anybody. He's a free agent. Would it bother me if I was Tucker? Look, there's enough stuff that's come out already that Tucker is maybe... And I mean, they thought he wasn't a New York guy. That was come out early in the thing. And then there was the sour grapes that came out of the Cubs clubhouse that talked about the player being on his phone instead of really locked in. As far as Scherzer and Verlander, they gave a shot on older pitchers. It didn't work. The clubhouse being a mess, I think that's overstated a little bit. Obviously, they felt they needed a mix of players that are different. I mean, I think one of the examples of that is here's a Marcus Semien working out in Texas, bringing Brett Beatty in and kind of mentoring him on second base and defense. You know, Polanco's been known to be that kind of guy. Bo Bichette is an intense guy. I think they want a different type of intense personality, less of a... here's what the word I would use with the clubhouse. I think they felt they were too comfortable. And that's fair. They've been here a long time. They've seen some success. They feel like they could turn it on and turn it off. And I think that that was something that they were done with. So as far as getting guys and then not getting, yes, it happened with Mattson Bauer. I don't think they ever felt they got Tucker. I think they had a good offer. I think Bauer, he himself tweeted out some jerseys, Mets jerseys on his website. I think Bauer played into that a little bit, less than Cohen. The Mats thing was just, hey, they shopped the offer. It turned out to be the right thing for the Mets. They wouldn't have gotten a great deal out of Mats. Mats was on the flip side there. So I understand your point, George. I wouldn't get too crazy about it. I don't. It's not something I'm going to lose a ton of sleep over. I think the Cohen tweets, if we can't have fun, because I think it's fun, because he was trying to get involved in the fan excitement. If we can't have fun like that, then the two of them got to get off the social media. The wife, Alex Cohen, has already got off social media. Go up into the ivory tower, and then everyone's going to hate them for that, just like the Wilpons. So you can't really win when you're in that spot. I would have some fun if I was the owner. I'd be careful, of course, but I don't see any harm in that. And I think the Mets fans, and I'm not saying that you're doing anything wrong, George. I'm not saying that. You got to calm down a little bit. You just got to. You're too intense. You're too intense. Let's have some fun with this. I want to thank Zachary, who humbly, I'm going to say this humbly, Zachary is one of the first people that emailed me and said, first time caller, long time listener. And I appreciate that. And he thanked me for my perspective. And he wrote me a very nice note. I'm not going to read the whole note on the air. But the point that Zachary made, and he made some really, and he's a New York guy, grew up in upstate New York rooting for the B-Mets, who are now the Rumble Ponies. And he talked about how difficult it is for the Mets because Cohen's been owner for 5 years. But because of what he took over, the Madoff scandal, the failures, all the things that came with the Mets and being a Mets fan over the last two decades, really the 06 to Madoff period really spiraled them in a separate category. That's, I think, where the LOL Mets happened, the way that they blew 06 and then the Madoff and all that stuff and the collapse. I think that that's where the demarcation line is. And he pointed out that, you know, you need about 10 years to get this done. And he also pointed out, and I think this is another great point, how right now it's almost like the newer age fan, maybe on social media, maybe it's the consumerism of our society, the attention deficit disorder that social media creates. It's all about immediacy. I want, you know, today, the Phillies sign someone, I need the Mets to respond with a move. And the offseason has become kind of this game. It's almost like an app, like, you know, free agent mogul app. And like, who can sign the most free agents for the best value deal for the most money to outsmart their opponents? And that is, I guess, at the core what free agency really intends to be for the money perspective, but it's not how you build a team. So, Zach, I did get your email. It was a great email. It was a humbling email. I appreciate the kind words, and I'm glad that you appreciate the balanced perspective we have here. But I'll tell you what, this offseason has been so... I mean, this has been a wild offseason. I mean, between the losing Pete and Diaz, the amount of conversations about that, the Dodger largesse, the Phillies getting spurned by Bo Bichette, the free agency lagging into the late January, the high AAV short-term deals, Boris, all the things that go, it's been a crazy offseason. So Frank wrote to me over on the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. MLB has a major problem to deal with next offseason. A workout stoppage is inevitable. Look, the players are basically saying, hey, we're not going to strike. They're going to force the owners to lock them out. The question will be, can Rob Manfred convince the owners, who he works for, that having a negotiation and having a sensible negotiation without burning the building down? Because in this day and age, a sport that is slow, that is long, that consumes a lot of time. I just talked about what the consumerism and the ADD-ness of the current world we live in, and how people move on quick, and they have a lot of different things that they could play into, apps and gambling and other sports and fantasy and things that have nothing to do with the four major sports. There are people out there that love European football. They love sports that we wouldn't even think are sports. They like players instead of teams. They like clips instead of games. Like, these are things that while you're trying to figure out how to slice up the pie or try to burn down the players' union, that are going to, in the end, be what you will be what kills your overall business. There's been talk of like owners hardened, and I know it's very early, and who knows if the rumors are true, very hardened on locking the thing out until they get what they want. Being out a year, year and a half, thinking about what happened in 94, 95, you cannot survive that again. There's no Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire coming through that door. You were in an extreme sports growth in the 90s with the NBA, the NHL. I mean, remember, you went from the sports being one level of revenue to explosion, mainly because of the amount of explosion the country had in its economy, the amount of explosion with the advent of the internet. And you're not, I mean, unless something's going to change, and anything could change in this world, there's AI, there's all this stuff. There's a lot of things they got to work out in terms of access to fans. There's no reason why there should be blackouts. I should be able to buy a Mets package on the MLB app and watch the Mets whenever the hell I want, regardless of where I am. I'll pay for it, especially with the cord cutting. I mean, cable, I pay $260 a month for cable, which I hardly use because I got the streaming apps. Not that I'm trying to complain about my budget. I'm lucky that I could afford it. I'm not trying to complain here. That's a good problem to have, right? But honestly, I'd want to cancel the cable, the Verizon, keep the internet, because I don't really use it. I use my apps. And the only reason I keep it is because of the Knicks and the Mets. I've heard the Gotham Sports app is a mess, and the Mets, I have to think. Probably some of you, if any of you have advice, and I always get afraid that, you know, now with the way the Verizon is, it's connected to the internet. So if the internet goes down, I'm not going to be able to watch the game anyway. It used to be I'd keep the cable because if the internet went down, for the game would still be or whatever. So, you know, sometimes streaming can get wonky. So Tim writes, the evil empire strikes again. Steve Cohen has to be careful when he puts out on Twitter. Players don't want their bosses putting their laundry out like that. Tucker has an aloof personality. Dodgers executives probably laugh their blanks off at Cohen. Don't have to be the funny guy at the moment. It's a bad look. Now take the $50 million invested elsewhere. He did. This happened right before the Boba Shet signing. So, hey, Tim, look, it looks like he listened to you, Steve Cohen. And again, Tim, I'll tell you what I said to George. It doesn't really drive me away. Sam wrote to me that, you know, the Dodgers get out whatever they want. It's taken away my love for the sport. This is what we thought Cohen and Stearns would be. I'm jealous and bitter. We stand no chance. Tucker was using us just like Bauer in 21. Please, Uncle Steve, stay away from the Twitter. Don't play with Mets fans' emotions. We'll never be the Dodgers. I'm beyond deflated. Who even cares? I haven't heard from Sam since the Bichette signing. And I think that's the real thing with Cohen. I think the Mets fans are so wound up and so thirsty for success. And I think that they had this vision that things, and I said this from the start when Cohen took over, it's not a yellow brick road to success. But for the rest of our lives, there's going to be bumps, even with money. Money just gives you opportunity. Money doesn't solve everything. Money makes it easier, but it doesn't make it perfect. And I think Mets fans are learning that. And remember that. If they didn't have the money, they wouldn't even be at the altar here. Now they're at the altar. Now there comes the big money problems. And the big money problems are the things we're talking about. Sam, I think that we're taking it way too seriously. I think, it was disappointing how the thing that, how Tucker went, but the whole way that we interacted on social media and the excitement, that's kind of what it's there for, to entertain us. It was entertaining. It just didn't come out that way. Let's do one more here. So, no, two more. So I got this, and he didn't give me his name. So he writes, So the Mets have a growing inside with the best players who have most choice of teams that elect not to come to the Mets. And could it be a conflict with Stern's style and personality? Seems we were starting to be a career destination choice, but the shakeup, botched negotiations with Diaz and team culture seem to have shifted it backwards again. I don't know about that. I just think that Stearns has a methodical approach that doesn't make for an entertaining offseason. I think the Diaz situation was as much Diaz as the Mets. They never wanted Alonso. Could they have read Diaz wrong? Maybe they read Diaz wrong to being more loyal and more connected to the organization than he was. I just think he got in there with the Dodgers and started thinking about it and started looking at it and just said, why don't I just join the, you know, join the best of the best? I mean, it is L.A., and he gets to then, in his eyes, have a very high chance of being on the big stage and playing in a big game, where he may have that chance with the Mets right now, but he has a very good chance with the Dodgers. And that was it. I think he was going to go to L.A. no matter what. Now, if the Mets blew him away with a longer-term offer where the Dodgers had a shorter term, I think that's maybe where they miscalculated, where they thought if it was all even, he would come back to the Mets. You know, I guess they underestimated the Dodger connection there. I'm sure they're not going to do that now. I'm also not so sure that they didn't want to lose him, but I didn't think that they looked at him as somebody that was insurmountable that they couldn't lose. So I think it's very risky downgrading to Devin Williams, and it would have been risky signing Diaz a long-term deal, because I'm still saying, you know, when is he going to, because there's always been those velocity issues. When is it going to finally pop? And it hasn't. And, you know, well, now it's the Dodgers' problem. So finally, our friend Jeff Cohen, he wanted to get something off his chest. We'll end with this. I'm convinced that the baseball world, non-Mets fans, want to keep the LOL Mets theme going for as long as they can. The latest one is that Bo Bichette will play third base and Jorge Polanco will play first. I get that they have not played there before, but players move positions all the time. Being a shortstop, they're the most athletic players in the field, and we have seen even Hall of Famers move from shortstop to the outfield and infield positions. This is the only thing. This is only a thing because of the run prevention statement that Stearns made, and I get it, but Bichette was going to Philly to play, wait for it, third base, and the Mets kept him away from a rival. As for first base, and I know there have been great first basemen, so don't get me wrong here, but of all the nine defensive positions, first base is the least defensive of them all. Will Bichette win a gold glove? No, but will he be able to handle third base now that bunting is practically non-existent? Of course. Get this, a friend, Yankee fan, has been trolling me, asking me as of now who is playing left field. I said no one since only January 18th, but I guarantee there will be a player playing left field on opening day in the following 161 games. The Mets need to win consistently to get rid of the LOL narrative. Sorry, ran over. Look, Jeff, you just said everything. I'm not even going to comment on it. You just answered the way I would answer. Yes, they want to keep it going. Yes, it goes back to what I just said earlier. The offseason has become this kind of, you know, game. You know, we'll see, you know, so that whole thing. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to the Talking Mets podcast. Hope everybody enjoyed this show. Sorry it was a little bit later. Wanted to see what was going on in the free agent market. At this point, we'll be back next Sunday, but who knows, with the way that the news cycle's been going, we may be back later today. I'm tired. It's a fun tired. I'm enjoying it. I hope you enjoy. And like I said, it's kind of a working thing, this extra innings, the premium content, Talking Mets extra innings. And, you know, I'm supposed to upload it right after this for the premium members, commercial free, to the podcast feed. Let me know if it works. I'm going to play around with it. This is new, so be patient. And of course, for those who don't want to be premium members, that's great. Continue to get it at your favorite podcasting service. Of course, you can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X, Talking Mets No G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy your Monday. Enjoy your day off if you have it. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.